Hey, everybody, and welcome back to another edition of the Roost Podcast. As always, I am Carter Spires, here with my co-host Matthew Bartlett, the owner and managing editor of The Roost, your premier source for Rice sports news and analysis. This is our season review episode for football, so we're going to go through and kind of do some broad thoughts and wrap up things on each side of the ball, and then we're going to go through and give out some awards that we'll call the Roosties. And for some, you know, some fun categories to wrap up some fun moments and storylines and players to talk about from the season.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. We made it through an entire season. And y'all kept listening.
Can't imagine why.
20 episodes. I guess this is officially will be episode 21. How about that? That's pretty cool. Yeah. So like Carter mentioned, we kind of tried to focus just on UTEP. And hopefully we don't have to say that sentence for another year. And then this week we'll be kind of going in big picture stuff. So first thing I wanted to remind you guys, if you hadn't yet, please go ahead and go out onto the website at theroost.com and go fill out that postseason survey. It should only take you a couple minutes. And it was really useful for me in the off season, just kind of putting things together and figuring out, you know, what y'all liked, what you didn't like, what you want more of. One of the things was a podcast, and lo and behold, we're here. So if you could, please, a Christmas present from us at The Roost, if you could go ahead and take that survey, that would be super appreciative. And then if you want some Roost-branded Christmas items, which, you know, you could put under your tree from Santa or from yourself, whoever you like, you can go ahead to attheroost.com/shop and go ahead and find some good. We got mugs and t-shirts. We got a baby onesie, everything on there. So go ahead and support us as we try and put this together, and then that's enough of the housekeeping things, and we can turn back to football and kind of wrap up the season, put a bow on it. It is Christmas, after all.
Yeah, I guess we could start with the offense first. We might as well save the best for last, as it were. So, the Rice offense this season was a work in progress, shall we say. I think the biggest thing that we had really hoped for this season that would be solved compared to the 2018 season is that there wouldn't be so much shuffling at quarterback. Unfortunately, it kind of worked out the same way as the 2018 season at quarterback. Yeah, no. And in almost kind of the same way, too. Like, not quite the sort of, you know, last year you started out with the grad transfer, Sean Stankavage, getting a little more of the snaps, and then you kind of went through some other guys a little bit more later on in the season. Whereas this one, we kind of went in reverse, where we started the season with Wiley Green getting more of the snaps, except when forced by injury, and then the this year's grad transfer, Tom Stewart, kind of really taking over full-time when he was healthy at the end of the season. So the events weren't quite in the same order, I guess, but a lot of the beats and a lot of the roles were the same, if you will.
Yeah, and the end result last season they scored 15.6 points per game, and I'm only talking in Conference USA terms, holding out that non-conference schedules, which were not apples to apples year over year. So 15.6 points per game last year, 20.1 points per game this year. So about a touchdown better than they were last year, which is kind of what it felt going along the season with all the quarterback issues and maybe not issues, at least inconsistencies.
Right.
It kind of felt like there were moments where you're like, okay, I think we have an identity that's working. And those particularly came at the end of the season. Their last three games, they scored 31, 20, and 30 after exceeding 20 points once throughout the first, what's that, five conference games before that, and that was against UTSA.
Yeah, and they didn't break, they didn't break 30 one time in conference play last year. The highest two totals were 26 and 27 versus UTEP and Old Dominion. So progress.
Which is bizarre because in those games, those were four quarter scoring efforts. Like they hung 31 more than they hung on any conference opponent all season against Middle Tennessee in the first half. So if you can put four quarters of the offense that we saw at the end of the season together, Like, is it unfair to have an expectation that this offense scores 40 at least once next season?
Yeah, or even that you just sort of, you know, raise the average so that you're consistently scoring, like...
Yeah, no more sixes.
Like, yeah, like 24 to 35 points. Like, if you expect to, you know, we'll talk about more about the defense later, obviously, but if you expect this defense to essentially be able to replicate the level of play it put together this year in conference play, and, you know, no team is the same, even if you bring back almost all of the players, even if you brought back all the players, teams just aren't quite the same from year to year. So you never know what's going to happen, but, you know, you usually don't get worse by bringing back all your guys. So I think that's a sort of a fair level of expectation for next year's defense. But, you know, if you're consistently putting out this same level of performance on defense and you can consistently score 24 to 35 points on offense, that'll set you up pretty good.
Well, and I think it's worth noting, like, if you just ask for 24 points a game, which, oh, I don't know what the FBS average is, but I would imagine that's, you know, somewhere around par. I'd imagine it's somewhere in the mid-20s. But if you just ask for 24 points a game and you put 24 points on Rice's offense this year, they held 7 of their 12 opponents, including Army and Baylor, who was arguably a win away from the college football playoff, to less than 24 points. I know you can't just artificially put a number on the board and that dynamics of the game change, but right, you're talking about a team that if you can just be consistent and get 3 touchdowns a game and a field goal or 2, you're bowl quality with this defense. And that is very important.
So, you know, that'll be the big thing, is the consistency to look for next year, I think. But yeah, I think you mentioned earlier what kind of the story for me was on offense, and it was essentially proof of concept. You saw that kind of all year with the defense, like with just what they were, like, consistently week in, week out. For the offense, you saw it at times, like there would be a drive here or a quarter there or a fantastic half against Middle Tennessee where you were like, okay, this, when, you know, in December of 2017, when you, you know, check the news and you see, oh, Rice hired Stanford's offensive coordinator to be their head coach, you could, and then, you know, you following up what Blomgren said about what they want to do and the hires they made on that side of the ball, and this, you saw for a little bit at a time what you imagined and what they wanted it to be, and you were like, okay, that's it, that's what they need to be. And if they can be that much more consistently, then you feel very good about where this program is headed and very good about where they would be if they were able to do that consistently. Whereas, like, in 2018, they were just doing whatever they could, which wasn't a whole lot. There wasn't really an identity to the offense at all. And even the times when they were scoring points, there really wasn't any cohesion to it. And I think we probably would have seen that more this year if there had been more consistency and more stability at quarterback. But that was the biggest thing for me, is that the identity didn't emerge on that side of the ball nearly as consistently as on the defense. But, like, you saw what it could become in a way that you just didn't last year really at all.
Yeah, and I guess my big question is really when the offense turned that corner was after the Marshall game, when they had that bye week and it really was, okay, let's take a step back and, you know, call it whatever you want, whether it's leaning less on the running game or opening things up or simplifying. The offense kind of took a shift when they asked Giovanni Johnson to come in and run things. And even when they reinserted Tom Stewart, it was a lot more of, you know, one back, one tight end, less, you know, two tight end, three tight end kind of schemes, and the offense was better like that. And so my biggest question going into this offseason is, okay, we saw that. We know that that might not be the ideal version of this offense that Blomgren and the coaching staff have kind of, you know, envisioned. Do they go back to where the offense was at the beginning of the year and try and get everyone on that same page with another year of experience? Or do they just say, hey, we have a new normal and this works, And that's going to be a big question entering next season.
Yeah. And it's interesting because, you know, I think one of the marks of the greatest coaches is their ability to adapt and change over time and to say, you know, this is what I wanted to do 5 years ago, but the game is not like that now. The players I have are not like that now. So, you know, it can either be a shift that takes place over time, like you look at with the way Alabama's changed on offense, the way TCU has changed on offense since, you know, roughly the start of the college football playoff. I think those are two really good examples. Or it can just be like a year-to-year type thing where you maybe the overall structure of your offense changes, but you know, every year you assess and you look at it going into the season and you say, well, the players we have this year have a really different skill set and than the guys we had last year. And, you know, hopefully there's not too much variance in that, because hopefully you're doing a good enough job evaluating and recruiting to the standard that you, or to the type that you want. But there's always going to be some variation, and it's always going to be on the coaching staff to find the right package of plays, you know, even if you're not really changing the structure of the offense, but to emphasize one thing over another. And so, you know, I don't think as long as the staff is here, you're ever going to see them, you know, go air raid and run mesh and Y stick five wide all the time. But like, you know, there's always going to be some of those elements of where you're, you know, under center in the I formation, you're running that power toss with two tight ends. And it's not like they got rid of that stuff at the end of the year. I mean, we still saw it at times, and it was still effective at times, and they still do that sort of stuff way more often than the vast majority of college football offenses do. And so they showed some ability to be effective with that stuff. So I don't think you ever expect them to get rid of it, and there's no reason to, but I think they need to take this opportunity in the spring to, now that they'll actually have a full roster, because I think that was probably an underrated part of why this team struggled a bit this year, is they really couldn't do a whole lot in the spring. I mean, you saw that closer than anyone, because they just didn't really have a whole roster in the spring. And so now that they have that this year, you really hope they take this chance and that they're able to get an accurate picture of, okay, what are these guys going to be capable of running next year? What do we need to keep the offense the way it was and develop that more based on what you did at the end of the year? Or is it the case of, okay, now we're in year three. Now we've got a full roster in the spring. Now we've got more players that we've recruited that fit the type that we want. Now we can go all in on running things the way we wanted to do them at the beginning of the season. And I have no preference as to one structure or the other. It's points. Just
I whatever structure scores, right, points.
Exactly. Like, just, you just need to make that assessment. What's going to work the best for this iteration of the team? And then you implement that, and that's who you can be going forward.
Yeah. And the biggest like question mark, obviously, is quarterback. That's going to kind of determine the floor and the ceiling and the consistency for the offense as a whole. But I think, you know, not having Juma Ottaviano for the majority of this season, I mean, he had really one big game where he was healthy. And then Zane Knipe, another guy that, you know, both of these guys were a part of the planning process. Juma in the spring and Zane in the fall, you know, as to the install of what this offense was going to look like, and both were out. So those are two big losses from the explosiveness side that they'll have to replace. But, you know, consider the parts they were working with and the guys that stepped up. I think we have to feel, you know, the offense probably got gradually better this year, mm-hmm. but hasn't made that jump to, you know, where it could be. And I think that the pieces and tweaks could be made to get there. And if they can get to, shoot, how many teams are going to beat this team if they can score 27, 28 points a game? Like,
not many in CUSA.
Yeah, you're talking about, you know, a conference title contender. And so that's, and the offense has to get there. And so far we have two seasons of evidence that says they haven't been healthy enough or had the right pieces in there to do it. So it's not going to be an easy task, but, you know, it's there. It's possible. Just haven't seen it.
Yeah. And it's, Yeah, I think it really comes down to quarterback. Yeah, you know, we've said it, and it's such an obvious thing, but, you know, you look at the other positions they have. I mean, they don't lose any of their tight ends. They don't lose any other wide receivers. They do lose a couple of backs, but, you know, they should hopefully get back Juma fully healthy. They, you know, they have a couple other guys waiting in the wings, some recruits coming in. You're not, I don't think we're really worried about replacing the production at running back. On the offensive line, you lose the three grad transfers, but, you know, you actually kind of had a situation where, like some injuries and some shuffling at the end kind of bought you a little bit for next season. You know, you had the emergence of Isaac Klarkowski at center, and you have Cole Garcia, who was a great starter his freshman year and then redshirted this year. And so you will be able to field, like, there's some uncertainty at offensive line because they are ultimately replacing three starters. But I think it's easy to feel confident in the guys they have and that they're bringing in to replace that production on the offensive line. Quarterback's just a total unknown, though, because, you know, right now your contenders are a true freshman who is incredibly athletic and has a really high ceiling, and you like what he brings in a lot of ways, but still very unpolished. We still don't know what his ceiling is and how close he is to it as a passer. You have Wiley Green, who, you know, we thought was the quarterback of the future for this year, but really had, you know, an inconsistent at best year, and was, you know, basically what, like the scout team quarterback by the end of the season. So, you know, is he going to be able, is he really in the mix to come back and win that job again? And then you've got, and I'm blanking on his name, but the quarterback they just signed, the junior college guy.
We'll sign TJ McMahon from Syracuse College.
About to.
For the 2020 class coming up, I guess next week.
So.
Yeah. So there's, that's a lot. What you're getting to is that we have the same questions really that we had last year. I guess the difference is now that we've seen, I feel like in 2018, we never really saw the full extent of what this offense could be. I feel like in 2019, we saw when it works, it works well, and this is what we can do. And so now it's, okay, we have a glimmer of hope of what it could be. So we'll have a lot here on this side of the ball to work through during the offseason, and once we get, you know, an incoming signing class in and how those pieces will fit. But overall, I think the offense, I'll say I'm a bit underwhelmed as a whole, but I am encouraged at the same time.
Okay, so moving on to the defense. A plus, you know.
Is there a grade better than that?
I mean, to consistently, like, I mean, they didn't give up more than 35 points in a conference game. And that was, they gave up more than 30 points twice. Like, in regulation, so, you know, we'll cheat a little bit and steal Louisiana Tech's overtime touchdown away from them. They gave up 17, 35, 31, 20, 20, 28, 14, 16 points. That's pretty solid. That's really, and you know, some of that is doesn't account for the fact that it's they played games at a pretty slow pace, so maybe the drive-by-drive and play-by-play numbers are a little uglier than that, but that's on purpose. That's what this team wants to do, is limit the possessions for other teams and limit their opportunities, and they did it really well. And, you know, they had some issues on the back end a little bit, not nearly to the degree that they had a year ago when it was, you know, you could basically count on, you know, okay, you start by spotting the other team to, you know, 40 plus yard touchdown passes a game, and depending on how good they are, you might toss in one or two more. They had a couple of those this year, but not nearly to that extent. And then the run defense was just stellar week after week after week after week.
Yeah, this year it really was. It was the point where think maybe once versus Marshall versus Southern Miss, one or two against Wake Forest. It was really, I have to think really hard about the instances when they happened, when a ball got over our heads. But it was at the point where maybe one hand, like this defense didn't let anybody behind them at all. And which, so here's something I thought that was interesting. So last year, they had the 12th best passing defense in the conference. This year, they had the 11th best passing defense in the conference, which I was kind of conceptually in my head. I'm like, that doesn't sound right. But so teams were still able to move the ball, but the defense did a really good job of when they needed to make plays, making plays and not making an offense work for it. It wasn't, okay, you throw it 80 yards in one play. It's if you're going to go 80 yards down the field, you're going to need to complete six passes, which Conference USA quarterbacks, you know, that's not as easy as it sounds sometimes.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't know, you particularly limited it to conference play. Like, if you take out the UAB game, it, you know, if the long passes hadn't happened in that one, I mean, first of all, they probably win the game, but we're probably sitting here talking about how great the secondary was and how they, you know, basically didn't let anybody behind them all year. Like that game and the UAB and the Wake Forest game, like mm-hmm. there might be a play or two here and there for other teams. Like, didn't MTSU have a long one, like right after one of Rice's touchdowns in that, I think. But like
that wasn't over the heads. That was just a fast guy running straight up the middle.
Yeah. Like, and every defense, even the best ones, usually allow, like, you know, you're going to allow a couple of those plays a season. Like, if you ignore just the UAB and Wake Forest games, I think that completely changes how we even think about how they played on that end. And we're already talking about, well, hey, it was a big improvement. So even the bad spots were kind of limited to a couple games.
And just as a frame of reference, even with, I think we did see overall, I mean, the jump that they had in scoring defense, they went from the 12th best scoring defense in conference to the 6th best. So that was noticeable. And when you put that up against, okay, so what does that really mean? So Western Kentucky, FAU, Marshall, Southern Miss, and UAB were the five scoring defenses that were better than Rice's. And when you go down the list of those teams, UAB, 9 wins, Southern Miss, 7 wins, Florida Atlantic, 10, Marshall, Western Kentucky, 8. So the only teams that had defenses that were more productive at keeping points off the board than Rice all went to bowl games. And most of them won 8-plus games.
Yeah.
And that's a very different... I mean, Western Kentucky doesn't have a stellar offense.
Right. And yeah, and almost all of those teams, you know, either in FAU's case, won the conference, UAB's made the conference title games, or were in contention for the league crown at the very end of the game. And is that... That's overall scoring defense for, like, the whole season?
Yeah, that in conference games.
Okay.
Taking out, you know, 50-7 trouncing at the hands of SEC opponents or whoever. But yeah, I mean, it makes you wonder. And on that front, what we're really, I thought, so this was an interesting dynamic, I thought, with the passing defense. Rice went from the 8th best rushing defense in conference play last year to the 3rd best rushing defense this season. And it really seemed watching these games that teams kind of tried to run the ball maybe. And I think UAB, this was a perfect example in the UAB game. Spencer Brown goes down early. They try running with their backup a couple times. And then they just say, no, we're just going to throw the ball for the rest of the game until the fourth quarter when it was out of hand. Uh-huh. But teams just kind of gave up trying to run on Rice because with that, the way the front seven was playing against the run, you really couldn't.
Right. And that's, you know, that puts the, you know, the stat about, you know, only moving up one spot in pass defense kind of into context. Teams threw a lot on Rice this year and got a lot of yards throwing because that was the only way they could move the ball, at least consistently. Like, last year they were the 12th. They were the 12th best passing defense in the conference, and you could run all over them. So,
got half of it solved.
Yeah.
And regardless how it happened, the important thing was, for the most part, they kept people out of the end zone.
Right.
And however you want to do that, if you want to have the number one passing defense in the conference and the worst rushing defense, like whatever the formula is, again, like the offense, score more points on defense, allow less points.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, like I alluded to when we were talking about the offense, the crazy, like usually for a group of five team, you know, a team in a conference like CUSA, when you build a defense like this, it's because you've recruited over time and developed some guys and had the classes line up just right. And you had a defense with a boatload of like seniors and redshirt juniors and upperclassmen and guys like that. A lot of sophomores and a fair number of juniors on this defense. So we've said it plenty of times. There was one true senior on this defense. It was Miles Adams.
Yeah.
Basically, I mean, everybody else in the 2D is back, which is insane.
Yeah, and then if you're following the Roost on Twitter, I put this out a couple of days ago, but I was doing my preseason or my postseason prep and kind of getting my stats all together. This is insane. Of course, we don't know anything about it, any potential transfers or injuries or anything like that, but Rice is going to return as of right now, just from graduation. Rice is projected to return 21 of their top 22 tacklers. And it gets better. Tacklers like 23, 24, 25, 26, like the next tier after that, are guys like Jordan Myers and Austin Trammell and guys who play offense that got two or three tackles this year because of turnovers. So literally everyone who contributed on defense and tackled other than Miles Adams is projected to come back.
Yeah, like this isn't even a situation
I don't think I've ever heard of that before.
No.
Ever.
Yeah, it's like one guy out of your whole 2D, out of your whole everybody who played snaps, basically, on your defense. It was one guy.
Yeah, and DeBraylon Carroll ended up getting named a third team all freshman by Pro Football Focus, and he was he's the guy that you're going to backfill. The one leaving the gap of Miles Adams is probably going to be filled in by DeBraylon Carroll.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So that'll.
I think that's the defense.
Yeah. Yeah.
No complaints.
Good things ahead. Okay, we will now move into our little fun awards that we're going to give out.
One special teams note on.
Oh, right. Supposed to.
That's admirable. We've been told we can never forget punters or fullbacks on this show, which we did forget fullbacks. It would have been great if Reagan Williams was healthy, but
I'm gonna be giving Brendan Suckley a shout out later on.
Oh,
so
spoiler, there you go. So we got fullbacks covered. Don't worry. Special teams note. Good. I thought it was notable the correction that was made at kicker this year. It started at the beginning of the season, and the first couple games, it was like, oh no. Jack Fox left, and our special teams fell into pieces. But not only did it not, Chris Barnes came through and was really consistent for someone who had never kicked in a college game in his life or punted and was asked to do both this year. And then I count myself extremely skeptical when Coach Sabota told me in the offseason that, you know, we have two punters and we think we're going to use both of them.
Yes, the old dual punter system.
I said, and you think that's going to work? He said, why wouldn't it? Well,
it worked.
Chalk this up to a coach knowing what he's good at and it working. So kudos, Coach Sabota. You had probably two of the top, five or six punters in conference, at least.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. Excellent work. So overall, when Pete Lembo left for Memphis, there was kind of some uneasiness of like, I think the special teams will be okay. I just don't know if they'll be that good. And you lose Pete Lembo and you lose Jack Fox, and like special teams was great. It was an asset on this team.
Yeah. Really, really solid.
Now the fun stuff.
Yeah. All right. Well, our first Roosty Award goes to your favorite play of the season, which I guess award sort of implies that we like came together and like had a list of nominees and came to a consensus that we're going to. We have not discussed who we're going to bring up these categories.
This is completely shooting in the dark. Yeah. We'll see. I'm hoping we don't agree on all of them, but maybe we will. I'm sure there's some we will.
So the one I ended up going with for this was Treshawn Chamberlain's game-winning pass breakup against North Texas. Yep.
I second you.
Yeah. Because that's, you know, I tried to pick up, because like there wasn't one signature play on offense, really. Like there were some fun ones, like, you know, they had several like long runs that they got out of, you know, out of the sort of the jumbo formations and stuff like that, that were TDs. But like none of those really stands out like among the others, I don't think. I did, you know, list as kind of a possibility for the offense, and this one wasn't even a touchdown, but Aston's long run, the 64 yarder against that was against UTEP in the last one, I think, mm-hmm. When they were in 23 personnel and literally had all 22 guys within like a, you know, 10 yard radius of the ball. He somehow still broke it for 65 yards.
And I'll give two honorable mentions that I had for the offense. So first off, the first victory formation against the year against North Texas. That was cool. Like, I mean, not a lot going on there other than snapping the ball and kneeling it, but it took them, because no victory formation against middle, because that ended on the wild defensive play. So
right.
That was fun. And then, but my second honorable mention, I think it was 3rd and 11 run by Aston Walter against Middle Tennessee, when I was like, deja vu, are we going to run the ball, kick it to them with a minute left, like happened against UTSA like 4 weeks prior, and they're going to go down the field and they're going to win this game. But no, him coming through on 3rd and 11, the perfect blocking, that was wonderful. And those, like you said, like offense, a lot of like good moments here and there, but the hit on that Treshawn Chamberlain delivered. And then and aside, so these awards are probably more not the stock kind, more of the fun, and you know, we get to have a little bit of, you know, creativity on these selections. The more stereotypical offensive player of the year, defensive player of the year, things like that, I'm doing that on the site right now, and I just released this week defensive player of the year Treshawn Chamberlain for the Rice Owls, partly because of that hit, but partly just a culmination of like what he does at the Viper position, being everywhere over the field. I think that hit was just kind of a summation of he's everywhere. And if someone was going to go make the play on the field, like, why not him?
Yeah. And that was just, it was such a good, like, you know, it, you have sort of a narrow list to pick from, but like the other two, you know, Aston's long run against MTSU Aston's third down run against MTSU is probably the closest, but neither of the other two, I don't think, had a real, like, this was the game winning moment thing the way that this, you know, with,
yeah, in, like, they won the game.
Yeah, literally. And, you know, to like, with the circumstances, like, it was fourth down, and, you know, it wasn't just like, you know, he was in great coverage and forced a bad throw, and the guy that, like, if he had not made that hit, the guy would have caught the ball and North Texas almost certainly wins the game.
And that hit ensured that Mason Fine, the preseason Conference USA Player of the Year and arguably one of the two or three best quarterbacks in the history of this conference, did not throw a single touchdown pass against this defense, which is kind of just capstone. And we talked about turnarounds and even the passing defense, you know, this, the growth, that was just kind of a highlight of, we didn't see that play last year. Or a play like it.
Yeah.
So, and that was huge.
And then Mason Fine's team didn't go to a bowl, and they fired both of their coordinators from it. So, sorry, guys. Sorry, Rice cost you both your jobs.
Did you catch Tom Stewart's quote after the game about that? He said, were you aware that, you know, because of you winning today, that you were able to knock North Texas out of going to the bowl game?
And
he said, well, if we don't get to go, why should they? fun times.
All right, the next one is player you were the most wrong about. I think I know what direction you're gonna go on this, and that's a player I had as well, So I'm going to go in a slightly less obvious direction and kind of say, cheat here a little bit and say the upperclassmen interior defensive linemen. I'm particularly thinking about guys like Elijah Garcia.
You did this in the preseason preview as well. Stretch the rules on the question.
Yep, I did.
You went to Rice, didn't you?
You could, if you wanted to pick one, you could probably say Elijah Garcia here, but I was sort of thinking that, like, okay, defensive tackle, Miles Adams, pretty good. Who else do they have? Like, I was convinced early in the season that DeBraylon Carroll and DeBraylon Carroll got a fair amount of action, but maybe didn't have a role as big as I was expecting, and I really thought they were going to have to play Isaiah Floyd a lot more, just because I was like, man, I don't see the depth here. I don't, like, can Garcia be a consistent player? Can Javonte Hubbard at, like, 250 pounds play, like, nose tackle properly? Well, neither of those guys was a star on the defense, but, like, you don't have run defense as good as Rice did. And, yeah, like, the linebackers, particularly Blaze Aldridge, get a lot of the credit here. Like, they were kind of the flashy players, you know,
the highlights.
Yeah. But perhaps literally in the case of Blaze's hair, not that I'm sure it's not natural, but but you don't have run defense that good if you're not getting really quality defensive tackle play. And some of that was Adams and some of that was DeBraylon Carroll. But the other guy, the kind of unsung guys on the interior defensive line, you know, we didn't talk about them a lot. They didn't get a lot of awards or anything, but, like, Rice isn't as consistent along the defense without those guys. So,
yeah. And I think that's a really fair point, because I remember the conversation that we had in August, September, whenever we sat down the first time. We said, okay, you're trying to replace Rowe Zach Abercrombie, who were arguably, I mean, last year, two of the best six or seven players on the defense.
Mm-hmm.
And we were looking at the depth chart saying, well, I guess I don't really know. And yeah, I give you grace on not choosing one, because I think both what Elijah Garcia and Javonte Hubbard and Cam Valentine came in at the end and got some run at that game against UTEP, and he did pretty well. So I think I was pleasantly surprised. I thought, you know, if you can hold even on your ability to defend the run, that's a win. But they got better. So
yeah. And, like, Elijah Garcia, like, I didn't even realize this until I was looking up the stats earlier today. He was fifth on the team in tackles for loss with four. He had 50 total tackles, which is as many as Nyheim Smith had. And think about how much we talked about him.
And one of those guys plays on the interior of the defensive line.
Yeah.
That's, like, insane.
Like, Garcia had more tackles and tackles for loss than Miles Adams did. So, you know, yeah, if I'm being real precise about the category here, I'll narrow it to Elijah. But I thought all those guys were really better than I expected that they would be.
All right. And then I think you were right on where I was going. The player I was most wrong about before the season started was Aston Walter. And I watched his brother play enough that I probably should have known that this guy was just going to work hard enough that it didn't matter what box he was put in. But I remember in the preseason, we were going down the depth charts and I said, well, they have Juma, they have this new guy, Charlie Booker. There's so many quality depth pieces here. I mean, you have, at that point, Cam Montgomery was still in the picture, and I was just going down the list of Nashawn Ellerby, and I was like, okay, where does Aston fit? And I don't know. And I'm like, well, if I can't find a spot for him to fit, then I guess he won't be a big part of the offense. And lo and behold, scores 10 touchdowns, leads Rice in rushing, has what, probably five or six long touchdown runs of like 30 yards or more. We're talking about explosiveness. This was a guy who, if Aston Walter isn't here this season, like, an offense that was okay to poor becomes bad. He arguably was the key cog and the most central piece to making things work on a week in and week out basis. So my apologies, Aston. you had a rock star year.
Yeah, and you touched on these a little bit, but I think there are a couple of fair reasons to not expect that he would have the year he did, at least statistically. I mean, we obviously didn't expect Juma to spend most of the year being hurt. And like you said, there were so many backs on this roster, it was easy to assume, like, well, they're probably just, it's mostly going to be a committee type thing this year. Like, you know, they're not going to focus too much on any one guy. And I think if I thought Aston would have a big role, it was going to be in the role that his brother had last year. Like, because Austin last year had almost identical. He had 564 rushing yards and 525 receiving yards last year. So I thought, if anything, Aston was going to be the guy that they sort of moved around a little bit and you know, flexed him out some and got him to, you know, got him on some mismatches and stuff like that. But he was really ended up being just the lead dog at running back in a way that I didn't really expect.
Well, and more than just, I mean, the lead dog getting the bulk of the carries, but really the second half of the season. So starting with the game against Louisiana Tech, and there was kind of a maybe not a shift in attitude, but things kind of felt different once this team got into conference play. It's okay, that non-conference slate was hard, but this is where we're going to win. Things are going to turn around. So the Marshall game and the North Texas game were both games that he didn't really play, was injured. He had the flu against North Texas. So he had two games in conference play that you can throw out. Was not involved, didn't play. Every other game in conference play, every game, he rushed for 100 yards and a touchdown at a minimum.
Hold on, I got to look at this game log for a second.
112, Louisiana Tech, 102, UAB, 109, UTSA, 106, MTSU, 149, UTEP.
Wow, yeah.
You're telling me that this is the Mike Bloomgren offense. We should have known. There's going to be a workhouse. Maybe we did know. We just didn't know it was going to be Aston.
Right.
100 yards and a touchdown every single game in conference play that he was healthy.
And threw a touchdown, too, in one of those games where he couldn't really play. So,
yes,
and show off that arm a little bit.
We mentioned that on the podcast last week. Mm-hmm. Was literally told the coaches, I can't continue. And they said, but do you want to throw a pass? And he said, oh, okay, I can get one more play. And then he scored the touchdown right after that. So yeah. He scored a touchdown in the North Texas game, even though he only had two carries and threw one pass.
Yeah, and just showcased a really well-rounded skill set, I think. Like, he's not the fastest guy on the team. He's not the shiftiest. Like, I think I mentioned this on the pod, the sort of the one impactful game that Juma had, and in that I saw it in the film room for that week too. Like, if you watch them side by side, like, when Juma's healthy, he's got so much more like burst and shiftiness and ability to kind of move in short spaces and make guys miss, but.
And I was buying that right until I saw Aston rip off like 360-yard touchdown
runs. the thing I think really did it for him, like, he doesn't have the same physical gifts, but his vision was so good. Like, the number of plays I broke down that were long runs for him where it was like, you know, he made a nice cut. It wasn't like one of those things that you see in slow-mo and it makes you fall out of your chair. Like, I distinctly remember this one play from Saquon Barkley when he was at Penn State where it was like he made a jump cut on a dude and it was just like he teleported like 5 yards straight to his left. And I was like, how is that possible? And Aston is not that guy, but he had a number of plays where it's like he had to make a cut and it wasn't anything special physically that he did, but he saw a guy coming, he saw the hole, saw the angle that the guy had on him, and just made the right cut at the right time. And
that's a big
part of playing running back. It's an incredibly, plenty of guys are big, plenty of guys are strong, plenty of guys are fast, could catch the ball, you know, plow through tackles and stuff like that. But the vision is what separates you. That's what makes the greats. And I was really, really impressed with the vision that he showed on a lot of those long runs to just make the right cut at the right time.
Yeah. I mean, like another guy on the same team, like Nashawn Ellerbe is a guy who didn't have that level of vision. Like he's probably bigger and faster, or bigger and stronger than Aston for sure. Maybe not faster, but he just runs people over. And that worked, like against Army. It worked. But the ability to change direction on a dime and see where he needs to go and put his body there, like I was floored, very impressed with the year he had.
Mm-hmm. Our next category is most improved unit.
Now you can pick more than one person for this award.
Well, the funny part is I actually have two things listed and I didn't make a final selection. I have one on each side of the ball. I will, for my final choice, I will go with the secondary. You know, like we said, they still had some issues, but especially considering, like, you know, we talked about, I've mentioned this a ton, but like they rotate through guys like most teams don't do that in their secondary. Like they played a lot of dudes and got a really consistently high level of play from a lot of them. Like, I mean, we talked plenty about how they, you know, they had a really nice group at safety and, you know, Naeem Smith was so impressive coming in as a transfer. And, you know, after the season Pretty Calderon had last year, for him to basically get, you know, bumped to the third string safety because of how good Smith was. And then obviously George and Chamberlain. But, you know, they played several different dudes at corner this year and, you know, Bird and DeBones and Thornton and guys like that, and got a really nice level of play out of them. And, you know, like we were talking about, they bring back all those guys next year. So, you know, if they can just make the same progress they did from last year to this year as this year to next year, I'll feel really good about that unit.
Mm-hmm. And so, and I will come clean. I did have the secondary written down, but I have to make a last second pivot here. As we've been talking, I think we saw the secondary get better, but they didn't quite reach that level where, like you were talking to, where next year maybe they could. I think the most improved unit has to go, in my opinion, to the linebackers, because we were talking about how good they could be before the season and talking about, you know, I don't believe Blaze Aldridge or Antonio Montero were on either of the preseason All-CUSA lists, and Blaze was first-team All-CUSA linebacker that just came out this week. And then you have, mm-hmm. you know, Garrett Grammer, who probably would be a much more involved player on most defenses in Conference USA, but he can't get on the field, so he has to make contributions on special teams. And he... my special teams player of the year at the linebacker spot. And then just top to bottom, Myron Morrison and guys like that, that most casual fans probably weren't watching for their contributions on special teams and rotating through. This unit was dominant and arguably the best linebacking core in Conference USA and one of the best defensive position groups in Conference USA. They weren't great last year. Like they were rotating through so many guys and there were so many injuries and Blaze and Montero didn't really appear until halfway through last year. This year, they were elite and they most improved for sure.
Yeah. And I wasn't even really thinking about them when I first was thinking about candidates for this one, because
you kind of just assume that they've always been good, right?
Yeah. Cause we were excited about them coming into this season. And, you know, maybe it isn't as much. Well, I mean, I guess we don't know how much of their playing time last year was, you know, were they good enough to be, you know, how much did in-season improvement for them play a factor? But, you know, we've talked about in the preseason, we were like, these guys are both really good players and we're excited for them. And you know, I think they're going to be one of the best units on the team. But, you know, you go back and look at it, just, you know, don't evaluate.
You said a lot of things in the preseason that didn't exactly turn out accurate.
But, you know, you like forget the film, like just look at the basic stats for Blaze Aldridge in particular. Last year, 65 tackles, 4.5 tackles for loss. This year, 102 tackles and 21.5 tackles for loss.
Seems good.
That's why, like, I wouldn't have realized the discrepancy was that big. And some of that is on playing time, although he did play in 11 games last year, so it's not like he, you know, barely played till the end of the year. He wasn't a full-time starter till a little later on, but yeah, I don't think I appreciated, because I already expected them to be good coming in, I don't think I appreciated, maybe until today, how much better they were than even they could have been expected to be.
Yeah, pretty wild.
Okay, next one. Play or game you most want to redo? And of course, because I can't follow rules at all, I split the difference and went with a drive instead of one player, one game.
Confession, I didn't follow the rules either. And I'm pretty sure I came up with this category. I picked a drive.
I wonder if we picked the same one. It's Louisiana Tech's last offensive drive of regulation when they went down and tied the game. Ah, okay. See, I think if you, like, the whole tenor of the season probably changes if they hold on right there and win that game, their first, like, they've just had this rough stretch in out-of-conference play where, you know, they came close a couple times and were better than anyone expected, but, you know, four losses is still four losses. And if they had just been able to come out and play that first game and beat a conference front runner right away, like, what could that have done for, you know, forget about just like the narrative, like, what could that have done for their confidence? Like, maybe a result or two in between swings the other way, and, you know, maybe it doesn't make enough difference that you're getting to a bowl or something like that. But, like, I feel like that, like, just holding on right there could have changed the whole, even at minimum, the way we felt about conference play.
You're really close, but you're one game too late, in my opinion. That was a critical drive, but I want to go back and I want to replay the last drive of the first half against Baylor. So Rice in that game against a team that was one first down away from the first time beating Oklahoma, you know, a college football playoff caliber team. And remember, this is a week after Rice got ran out of the stadium at NRG against a Texas team that turned out was not very good, or better than Rice, but not great in the grand scheme of things. Rice gave the ball back to Baylor with like 40 seconds left, and Baylor went down the field and scored a touchdown at that point to make it 21-3. Versus going into halftime losing 14-3. Rice would score the only two scoring opportunities of that game. Final score was 21-13. If you're telling me in the fourth quarter, Tom Stewart, that was right after Wiley's scary collision that took him off the field. You're telling me in the fourth quarter, Tom Stewart can run in a touchdown at that point, and it's 14-12. And you're a 2-point conversion away from being tied with a team that won 10 games this year. Like, you're talking about a confidence booster against Louisiana Tech. Like, I know there's a lot more than one drive to play, and a lot more things can happen in a half against a team as good as Baylor. But shoot, you beat Baylor, then that's one that people aren't just talking about for us the last season. That's one they're talking about next year. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a fair choice.
And then if I had to limit to a play, the fourth down conversion against Army.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's the obvious one. Okay, player you'll miss the most. This is kind of a tough one because Rice is not losing very many players. I really didn't have a one that I felt strongly about for this one. I'll go with Miles Adams. Not because I think that he had a great season. I don't think he makes a huge difference, and not having him makes a huge difference in the outlook for the interior defensive line next year. Just so much as I really appreciate a guy like that who experienced a coaching change, and, you know, your whole system shifts, and a lot of guys, the guys in front of you in the previous season, and then the guys before, and some guys, you know, before the new coaching staff is even in. A lot of guys transfer out, a lot of guys lose their jobs, you know. It's such a weird situation to be in, to be a senior in this class who's gone through this coaching change, and, you know, you won, what, a total of
less than 10.
Yeah, less than 10 games in your career. That's a tough spot to be in. And so, you know, I have a lot of respect for guys who stuck it out through that and are now graduating seniors, you know, with a degree from Rice and have experienced through all that and stuck it out and were impact players through the end of their career. So,
yeah. And for the same reason, I know I've already given this guy an award, but I went back to Aston Walter, a 6-year senior who I do not have a twin. I could not imagine being in this situation, who could have ended his career last year with his brother and, you know, gone out. But for the first year, and I mean, these guys played together in high school. So I think the last time that these two guys weren't on the same football team, it's literally been a decade. And so for him to come back and willing it to go it alone and be one of those guys like Miles Adams that has seen the entire trajectory of this journey, like, he's the kind of guy that I don't think in the preseason I mentioned how I didn't appreciate enough of what he was to this team as a leader and as a player. He's one of those glue guys that holds everything together, that the intangible value of Aston Walter is almost greater than the on-field value. So he will be one. He was a great guy and one I really enjoyed covering, you know, just on a personal level. So he'll be one that I miss talking to for sure.
The next one is the out of nowhere star. Aston Walter is probably an easy choice here for stuff we have more or less gone over. The one I ended up picking was Brad Rosner, because, like, I think we had some excitement about him coming in, right? Like, oh, you get this 6'5 receiver from JUCO.
Led junior call-in touchdowns.
And it's like, you know, this is a guy who could come in with, you know, with the holes they had at receiver coming into the season, especially once after the Cephas suspension. You know, you're like, okay, well, let's see what this guy can do. But it maybe took him a little while to get going, but, like, he had a pretty, like, once they figured out that, oh, we can just throw the ball up to this guy and he will come down with it every single time.
Kind of like a cheat code.
Yeah, like, that'll do.
Yeah, like I mean, not absolutely a good choice. I went a bit more out of the box, maybe, in my out of nowhere star, and I went with Isaac Klarkowski.
I wrote down his name also, but
I know he only played in two games. But if you're telling me that, I mean, again, we're talking about intellectual brutality, ground and pound, run the ball, control the clock. That this is the identity of this offense. You lose your starting center. So Brian Chapin had a hand injury and wasn't able to snap going down the stretch. And then Shea Baker had the flu. So you're down your first two centers and you turn around and say, okay, who's going to snap the ball? Which, remember, Rice fumbled, what, 4 or 5 snaps in the first 6 games?
Yep.
You bring on a walk-on guy who wants to be a rocket scientist and was playing on defense with the scout team the week prior, and he starts your last two games and you win your last two games. Like, who knows how it shakes out last year? I don't think he's going to beat out Shea Baker for the starting center job, but wow. No one outside of the team knew his name. I was somebody, JP Heath, who does a great job with the radio for the Owls, texted me before the game. He said, hey, who's the third string center? And I said, I think it's Isaac, but he hasn't played this year. Just checking. Surprise. He started. So he gets the nod from me on that one. Although, you know, you can't go wrong with Brad Rosner.
Yeah. Okay, next is the most valuable transfer, because we had a number of them. I'm going to assume that we're disqualifying Blaze Aldridge from this award since he was already on the roster last year.
Yes, he was here.
Brad Rosner would be an easy and very defensible pick here. I don't know if there's one of the three grad transfers on the O-line that really stands out above the others. You could... Leverett was maybe the most consistent of the three. You could give a special award to Chafin for his last-minute tutelage of Klarkowski. I think the best choice for this award is probably Nyheim Smith, though.
Yeah, I mean, on the defensive side, I will admit I went back to Brad on his contributions.
Yeah,
I was
trying to spread the love around a little bit.
I get it, and I didn't pick Brad, so I can pick Brad for this one. But Nyheim, I went ahead and handed him my defensive newcomer of the year. Where I went, you know, I went freshman last year, but really this is a freshman to the program first year. And you know, we had Prudy Calderon, who was a rock star last year, had four interceptions, was a revelation, was so good in the secondary to the point where Nyheim got here. And I'm like, well, he looks like he's good against the run, but I don't know if he's going to get on the field. And not only did he get on the field, he would have finished fifth, sixth on the team in tackles, had 50 tackles. So heck of a year. And I am completely okay with that going to Nyheim Smith. And you've already touched on Brad, but man, again, you can't hardly get JUCO players into Rice. And between Brad, Nyheim, and Blaze Aldridge, you could argue three of the best, what, seven or eight players on the roster came from JUCO?
Mm-hmm.
Not bad.
Yeah, pretty good job of picking those guys out.
Coaching staff might know what they're doing.
The next one is the best block. Which I may have hinted at my selection for this one. And you can see this player real quick if you go to the website at theroots.com and you scroll back in the football section to my North Texas film room. The second play, it was Charlie Booker's lone rushing touchdown of the year. It was just a simple, it's an ISO run. So it's just an interior lead block run, and it's Suckley at starting fullback as he was over basically the whole last half, two thirds of the year. He comes in and he leads the way through the hole, and there's a linebacker there, and he meets him and drives him back about 4 yards, and then turns him towards the sideline and starts erasing him up that way. By which point, Charlie is already in the end zone. So you love to see a fullback. Space blocks are always nice when you see a guy get out there and just lock up on a dude and erase him out of a play. So that was my pick.
That's our fullback talk of the show.
Exactly. There you go.
That checks that box.
Covering all our bases.
I did look at that play and think on it, and I have already mentioned this play in the podcast, but I'm going on Aston Walters' third down and long run against Middle Tennessee, went 11 yards, which, you know, that play gets called and he gets 3 yards and everyone and their mother's screaming, "How could you call that play?" Because that play only works when everybody does their job. Mm-hmm. And not only did the offensive line create the perfect gap and for him to run through, but Yager Bull goes, I think he was spread out wide, sprints 8 yards down the field and engages a guy at the second or maybe the third level at that point. And that is if he doesn't block that guy, it's an 8 yard run on third and 11 and Rice punts. And I don't want to know what would have happened if you don't want to put the defense in that spot. He makes the play. Aston gets the next couple yards and Rice wins the game. So, Yager Bull, not a fullback, but a very, very good tight end. Had some good blocks this year, several.
Yeah, that was a really nice one. Okay, next up is the most dominant game. And my choice for this one, I think it was fairly easy, was Brad Rosner against Middle Tennessee. It basically all came in the first half, but 8 catches for 130 yards and 3 touchdowns that all looked exactly the same. He just went up. They just ran the most simple play, throw it to the tall guy in the end zone. And
can we just, I wanted to get into the headset of the MTSU defensive coordinator. Just what's the, at what point do you say, maybe we should cover him?
Or at what point do you say, hey, do we have any taller DBs? Like anybody? Like, you know, do we have
You're 6'8", go stand in the end zone. Yeah. Put your hands up.
You know, and I want to say that Brad mossed all those guys, but I feel like a mossing, obviously referring to NFL great Randy Moss, usually implies that you jumped over a dude and took the ball away from him.
You're right.
I don't think Brad jumped at all. I think he just stuck his hands up in the air and you know, it's like being a 5-year-old and having your much older brother, you know, hold the ball out of your reach and taunt you. Like, what do you even do?
No, you couldn't do anything. And, you know, that's a first half that, you know, if that first half could have gone on an extra 10, 15, 20 minutes, like, who's to say he doesn't have another touchdown or two? Like, that was unreal. I don't care if it was half a game. Like, at that point, I was shocked that he didn't end up, you know, with 4 or 5 touchdowns. Which, I mean, we're talking about players that, you know, improved and surprised us. We mentioned his name earlier. Like, we thought he was going to be pretty good. In no world did I envision a 180-yard, 3-touchdown game.
Yeah. If you want to pick a defensive performance here, the closest one I could come up with was, I know it sounds odd to pick a dominant defensive performance in a game where you gave up 48 points and got blown out, but Blaze Aldridge against Texas had 4.5 tackles for loss and a sack against a team, you know, they did not have a very good year, but that's still a team fielding an entire roster full of, like, NFL caliber athletes. So 4.5 tackles per loss in one game is that's pretty solid.
That wasn't too shabby. You could argue his game against UTEP to cap the season, season high, 14 tackles, 3.5 tackles for a loss. You know, starting quarterback goes down at halftime, and you're like, I don't think they're going to be able to do anything. Well, they didn't, because every time they tried, Blaze tackled somebody, usually behind the line. Yeah, you could pick. There's a couple games of his that you could choose from if you wanted to.
All right, and our final roosty of this podcast is the player you are most looking forward to seeing in 2020. I think there are a lot of different directions you could go with this one, probably. I ended up going with the easy one, which is Zane Knipe, a guy that we were looking forward to in the preseason and, you know, mostly due to injuries, ended up not playing as much as we had hoped he would, but we finally got a glimpse of him in the last couple of games, and they didn't do anything fancy. You know, he had one catch and ran a couple of jet sweeps, but each time it was like, oh, that's why they were excited about this guy. Like, you take the ball on those plays and just the defense knows what's coming, but only so much that matters when a guy's as fast as he is. So I'm really looking forward to him, you know, playing consistently, hopefully being healthy, expanding the route tree a little bit, and just being a guy who, you know, makes defensive coordinators panic a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I tweeted it out at some point. I think it was right after he made he had a 42-yard grab, his only reception of the season. 42-yard grab against UTEP. I tweeted it out. I think he ended up averaging the season 12.9. I think it was 12.9 yards per touch. Every time he touched the football, he got a first down. And you're looking at a team that needs explosiveness. I'm looking forward to Zane Knipe.
Yeah, and that's, you know, 12.9 yards per touch is like, it doesn't sound weird for a receiver, but like they're you know, you think of the most like explosive field stretchy receivers who only know how to run go routes and don't really do anything else and might have 10 catches for, you know, 300 yards or something like that. But This was not a situation, like I said, he had one catch. So the majority of his touches were runs. Because that's...
Yeah, I think he averaged 11 yards per carry, 44 yards on four runs.
That'll get it done.
It's not bad. And then on the receiving front, like you're talking, I mean, Brad Rosner, 14 yards a catch, and Austin Trammell, 12.1. I mean, I think Zane is going to be a guy. Both of those other guys caught 50 passes this year. Zane's not going to be a guy that catches 50 passes. He's probably going to catch somewhere between, 20 and 30. But those 20 and 30 shots are going to be shots. So, I mean, you had, I think, two years ago, Aaron Cephas led the country in yards per catch, averaged 24.9 yards per reception. That's the kind of line that you could expect from Zane next year. When he gets the ball, it's going to be downfield, and he's going to be running very fast. So Zane was my one guy, and I will kind of set us up for tee us up for the future with another one. Player I'm most looking forward to in 2020. I didn't say he had to be on the roster right now, so I'm going to cheat in a caveat. We're looking for playmakers on offense. Andrew Mason is a wide receiver that when signing day comes around, he will be a Rice Owl, and he's really fast. Maybe not Zane fast, but he's really fast. And he can catch. He's a receiver. And he is insane. He had a 7-touchdown game earlier this year. Which, again, we're talking about Middle Tennessee, right? There's one guy in the field who you're going to throw the ball to. Can you stop him? Andrew Mason is that kind of talent. So, especially if you already have a Zane Knipe on the field, when he arrives, being able to hopefully, spell him in and put him in and burst. He's not going to take over one of the starting jobs with the talent that Rice has right now. But man, anybody who can score 7 touchdowns against any level of competition when the defense knows, I think they're going to throw it to Andrew, I want that guy on my team.
Yeah. If you could say, if we expanded this to position group you're most excited about, you think about Rice's receiver group was basically a 2-man show this year. And then you get both of those guys back. You get Zane Knipe fully healthy. You get Jake Bailey, who, lest we forget, was one of the highest rated recruits in program history. Got a little playing time this year. And you bring a guy like Mason in. And, you're not going to be in like a lot of 4-receiver sets or anything like that. But you can rotate those guys in, keep them fresh, get him out there on some routes where, you have those speed guys really clearing the way.
It's pretty exciting. Against UAB, which neither of these plays counted because I think there was an offensive penalty on one and a defensive penalty on the other, but Rice lined up with 5 wide receivers. And, we talk about adapting to your personnel. If there's a situation where that gives Rice the best chance, here's my bold prediction. Rice will line up in 5 wide in multiple games next year. might not be like 30 plays. It might just be 3 plays.
Yeah.
But we're going to see it. And shoot, you're telling me we could have Trammell, Rosner, maybe August Pete, Zane, Andrew Mason, Jake Bailey. That's a... if you were a spread offense team and that was who you were trotting out, you'd feel pretty good about that.
Decent. All right. Well, any last thoughts before we wrap it up for this week?
Inaugural Roosties in the books. Thank you, everyone, who did send in some suggestions. We did get things like Best Block, who folks emailed in, Favorite Play, things like that. So thank you for putting those out there and helping us incorporate them into our show. We had a lot of fun doing it, and I was surprised we agreed on maybe less than I thought we would, but I think it made for pretty
nice
interesting conversation. Yeah. So this was fun. It was a good highlight to end the year on a team with 3 straight wins, and now you have 10 Roosties to tell your friends.
All right. Well, we will be back sometime in about the next week to wrap up, do a little recruiting talk with the early signing period coming up. So look forward to that. We'll see y'all then, and Rise Fight!
This show was edited and produced by Carter Spires. It features music from Joseph McDade.